Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Because I'm capping greenhouse gases, coal power plants, you know, natural gas, you name whatever the plants were, whatever the industry was, they would have to retrofit their operations.
That was then candidate Barack Obama back in January 2008 during an interview with the editorial board of the San Francisco Chronicle. The president's lack of progress on implementing a cap and trade system has been a frequent target of criticism from his base. They say the U.S. lags behind other industrialized nations in passing a strong environmental policy to head off global warming. But our next guest says, surprise, there are many reasons to be optimistic. And he's going to tell us why. He is William Hewitt. He's an environmental activist and the author of A Newer World, Politics, Money, Technology, and What's Really Being Done to Solve the Climate Crisis. Bill Hewitt, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
And in looking at your book, you appear to be more optimistic than many environmentalists about the progress being made with regard to solutions to combat and prevent climate change. Tell us why.
Well, let's start with federal policy, okay? President Obama has perhaps taken a bad rap. Cap and trade, in particular, was an exceedingly tough nut to crack. Okay, it passed in the House of Representatives in June of 2009 and then more or less just died an ignominious death in the Senate that fall. We were at that point on the cliff, as it were, of a financial crisis, plus the politics in the Senate, both on the Republican and the Democratic side, really make such a program at the federal level quite difficult to accomplish. All right? So with the federal government, we have had really tremendous progress. So for instance, when Barack Obama took office, one of the first things he did was he charged the Environmental Protection Agency with looking at whether or not greenhouse gases, and not just carbon dioxide, but methane, nitrous oxide, and some others, were an endangerment to the public health and the environment. And lo and behold, not surprisingly, they found that greenhouse gases were indeed an endangerment. So the Environmental Protection Agency, absent federal legislation, moved under the Clean Air Act to start to institute a regime of greenhouse gas controls, for instance.
So he used the old-time pollution laws without having to get any new laws enacted with respect to global warming, climate change, because these things were also found to be pollutants in the old-fashioned sense.
That's correct. That's correct. Not in the sense of carbon monoxide and ozone and some of the other what are called criteria pollutants, but in as much as the Clean Air Act requires EPA to determine whether or not any air pollutants pose an endangerment. Beyond that, and that regime is moving forward slowly but surely. Beyond that, for instance, the administration worked with the auto industry, worked with the unions, worked with representatives from Michigan and other important states relative to the auto industry to essentially double the mileage requirements for vehicles sold in the United States.
So there are some things that the Obama administration has done that you say have had an impact on global warming, despite his reputation for not having been able to get cap and trade or much of anything through. Let me go on to another aspect. Corporations, often the target of environmentalists' most pointed criticism, obviously. But in the book, you write somewhat approvingly of the role of some giant multinationals like Walmart and DuPont. Talk about what's going on at the corporate level that encourage you to.
Renewable energy. For instance, there was $257 billion committed for investment in renewable energy, almost two-thirds or better of which came from the private sector in 2011. That number is going to be more for 2012. And those numbers reflect the fact that companies all over the world, like Siemens, like General Electric, and others, know that this is a growth industry. They know that there is tremendous potential to be had in renewable energy. There are extraordinary commitments. That $257 billion in 2011 was $40 billion more than money invested in fossil fuels. And yes, many of the big companies like Walmart are looking at their supply chain. They're looking at their fleets in order to, A, reduce costs to improve their bottom lines, but also because they're fully cognizant of the fact that we are in a world now where greenhouse gases need to be reduced, where sustainability needs to be a program at the corporate level. A nonprofit organization based in Boston, Ceres, for instance, does tremendous work with corporations. They go and they work with the boards to make them better aware of sustainability concerns, to get them to commit to various, quantifiable programs to reduce their greenhouse gases, and also very much to be sensitive to concerns of investors.
And yet, what I hear is that despite all of these examples that you're citing, they may only be making a difference around the edges, and that the real reason that the greenhouse gas emissions in the United States have actually started to decline is because of the shale revolution and using more natural gas instead of other fossil fuels.
That is to a great extent true. And the reason for that is very simply that gas is supplanting coal as a fuel for power production. And we have gotten to pretty much the same percentage of electricity coming from gas as from coal in the past year. This is now 32% more or less for both coal and for gas, and that percentage has been going up for gas and been going down from as high as the mid-50s.
What do you think as an environmentalist? Go ahead, finish the thought.
Only 5 or 6 years ago, so we've been radically reducing our coal consumption.
What do you think about shale and natural gas? Obviously, fracking is such a huge environmental cause of debate right now, and it has upsides and it has downsides. Where do you come down?
I get asked this in my classes at NYU. Here's the thing about gas. Okay, let's look at some of the upside. Gas, as we've just noted, has been the principal driver in reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the United States over the past 5 or 6 years because it is 50% more efficient. It produces 50% less carbon dioxide in combustion than coal does. It has virtually none of the pollutants like sulfur dioxide, like nitrogen oxides, like particulates, and mercury that coal has, okay? It is ubiquitous, and we can use it in a number of different ways, not just only in big thermal power plants, but we can also use it in cogeneration, okay? So cogeneration is simply using the power and the heat produced in a facility, such as we have in Washington Square at NYU, which has 90% efficiency, in order to maximize the use of that fossil fuel. So the downside, obviously, is that there are potential dangers to water supply and probably more importantly in terms of air pollution. So the fact that there could be fugitive gases, primarily methane, which is the component that gets burned, can exacerbate air pollution concerns, can also, frankly, escape, and methane itself is a very potent greenhouse gas. It is incumbent upon any regulatory regime, federal, state, wherever to make sure that fracking is done with the best engineering practices. And frankly, this is what we've been doing for 40 years with the Clean Air Act, with the Clean Water Act. We've been requiring companies to do
best available technology that's
exactly,
in the law.
Exactly.
So last thing. In spite of all the positive developments that you lay out in the book, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, issues their assessment reports every few years ago, and you acknowledge that each report has grown consistently more dire. So how can you be so optimistic in light of the IPCC's conclusions that things are getting gradually more extreme?
My optimism is balanced with the clear recognition that we're in the soup. Okay, the book makes it quite plain that the science is well established, very deep, very broad. That greenhouse gases are exacerbating warming, which is leading to all sorts of impacts. Okay, some of which we saw in New York fairly recently, and the good news is that we do need to mitigate the production of those greenhouse gases. All right, the IPCC has been saying that since 1990. Others were saying that before. And any number of bodies like the National Science Academies of 15 countries, from Russia to the UK to France to the US and China, say that this is absolutely a necessity, that we need to reduce our greenhouse gas production. And we, because of renewables, because of green building, because of the uptake of sustainable agriculture in many places in the world, because of the reductions we're seeing in deforestation in Brazil, among other places, and because of people know more. They are concerned more. They're taking this on as part of their lives. So recognition of energy efficiency and energy conservation, buying electric vehicles, buying hybrids, thinking more about how they eat and what they eat.
And does all that outweigh the industrialization of 2 billion people in India and China?
That's a question that I'm not in a position to answer. The trends on renewable energy, on any number of other things, indicate that we are really, really moving on a track and at a pace that 10 years ago, people who work in the renewable energy industry, environmentalists, would not have told you that in the year 2013 we would be achieving. That's one important aspect of this, among others.
Well, let's hope your optimism is founded. William Hewitt, environmental activist, professor of environmental science at NYU?
At the Center for Global Affairs. So it's more in the context of global affairs, mm-hmm. Policy and politics more.
And the author now of A Newer World, Politics, Money, Technology, and What's Really Being Done to Solve the Climate Crisis. Thank you so much.
Thank you.